We've been going through a series of discussions looking at some of the basic principles in early Buddhism. We started talking, thank you, Natalia. I like that. It's absence of sound. We started off talking about going for refuge and the practice of the precepts, the ethical practices, and then touched into the insight or wisdom investigations, particularly looking at the three characteristics of all conditioned things: transience, unsatisfactoriness, and selflessness. And I want to retreat from the precipice of not self now back into something kind of a little more. I'm going to go back to the beginning in a certain way. In the early texts, and by that I mean the Pali Canon associated with the Theravada school of early Buddhism, it's the oldest extant body of texts that we have and body of practices that we have associated with the historical Buddha, predating Zen, predating Tibetan practice, and really a beautiful, concise, and in an interesting way, non-mystical body of teachings. A gorgeous body of both philosophy and social ethic. And it's a description of practice that's direct and really quite accessible. And in those texts, so in some of the earliest record we have, the Buddhist path is described in a number of ways. There's the list of the eight factors of the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, often talked about as a kind of first wisdom investigation. But when the Buddha would lay out the path in what's called the gradual path, which was really emphasized that we don't get to the depths of, you know, existential inquiry immediately. You don't just kind of walk in off the street and the teacher says, you know, right on, so glad you're here. You know, okay, there's no self, there's no God, you know, cause and effect conditions everything, and the thing to do is to become liberated by non-binding. Like you don't do that sort of straight in off the street. People would walk into the Buddha and, you know, and he would say, okay, I'm going to teach you the gradual path. And the path begins with giving. And so this is the first quality or practice listed in the gradual path. It's almost never taught on in Western Buddhism. It's the cornerstone of most South and South Asian Buddhisms. In some ways, the cornerstone of many of the cultural Buddhisms, so the places where Buddhism has become a central part of the culture itself. And it's followed by ethical practice and then by cultivation of the meditative and inquiry aspects of the path. And the shorthand for this whole sequence is three Pali words, dana, sila, bhavana. And where dana is giving, the practice of giving. Sila is ethical action, which we've been talking about a bunch. And then bhavana means cultivation or bringing about, refining, purifying. And that's the catch-all for really all of the, what we would generally call practices, meditation, visualizations, reflections on the nature of reality and the self, etc. So, dana. The word dana in Western practice is often associated only with the giving of monetary donations at the end of a class or at the end of a retreat. And teachers will say, you know, in the sort of teaching community, you know, at the end of a retreat or a day long or something, teachers will be like, do you want to give the dana talk? Do you want to give the dana talk? Meaning, do you want to give the little spiel that says this is an ancient practice, we're offering it freely, but we need your donations to keep going, yada, yada. That's called the dana talk, right? I've given a gazillion of them, little tiny ones, to you all and others. One of the weird things about the dana talk that becomes apparent once you've given hundreds of them is that very subtle variations in the words used seem to predictably lead to very substantial differences in amount of donation given. So saying specific things about it tends to lead to more donations given. Saying other things tends to lead to less. There's a whole this whole study that one figures out about this. And then, of course, one has to practice to actually say what feels right to say, rather than kind of angle for, you know, bigger donations. But the whole thing is a bit of a mess in the West, partly because it was initially taught in a very, very different cultural context. And that cultural context was different in a lot of ways. In one specific way, this was a culture where first of all, there was a widely culturally accepted place for individuals who chose not to participate directly in the economic scene and would become mendicants, beggars, essentially, contemplative practitioners who would sustain themselves purely on the gifts of others. And we think of that perhaps as a very small contingent of people. We think of like spiritual teachers doing that now, or people who live at ashrams. This is a very small number for our culture. But there were actually times when it was a very substantial population of people, you know. And so then what you get is a system where there would be these cities, centers of commerce, where there would be, you know, the caste system happening, sort of wealthy landowners supporting priests, also then kind of employing other merchants and laborers, and all of that income generation going, in a certain way, in a operating in a kind of feudal model, where it would be concentrated in these kind of, you know, chieftains or sort of little local kingships or landlordships, and those people, and this is described in the text. If you're one of those people, namely the wealthy, your primary responsibility is to take care of a lot of people. So it lists like the thing to do is to use your wealth to feed and clothe and house and support with medicinal support your family, all of your workers, all of the people, you know, employed by all the people that you employ kind of outward, including like small armies, you know, like mercenary armies that you would use to travel between towns because it was dangerous to move around. And really you're supporting a vast kind of network of people. So this is a sort of, it's not a capitalist system. It's really a feudal system where held together by this ethical model that says the rich actually support a whole bunch of people. And on top of that, the rich would then be expected to support in a very vigorous way contemplatives, beggars who have gone to the woods to practice. And many wealthy people would... the Buddha was supported by several very wealthy donors in his time, who would support not just him, but thousands and thousands of monks and nuns. A given donor would support, you know, many, many people. So this is a system then where there would be these centers of commerce, and then in the wilderness surrounding them, there would be monasteries, ashrams, independent encampments, all, and you know, thousands of people, all dependent on offerings. So then, naturally, perhaps, you know, that system has to be maintained somehow by a belief structure, and that belief structure comes out in this first step in the path, which is the first thing you have to learn to do is to give stuff away, and it folds into the whole rest of the path, because once you get on to inquiring into the nature of your experience and why there's stress, why there's anxiety, why there's suffering, the main reason given in the noble truths, the second noble truth, is that the cause of suffering is grasping. It's holding on to things. Experiences, material things, thoughts, feelings, the sense of self, everything that we hold on to get a bit of safety or security from. And so then you get this material practice of using the resources of money and material resources to support many, many, many people, if you have the resources to do so. And then to be supported, if you're a contemplative or a renunciate, or you've renounced earning it yourself. but also to be supported if you're a laborer, for instance. You know, there wasn't the sense of like, oh, you're a laborer, then you're going to work up to being an entrepreneur, and then you're going to buy your house, and you're going to work up to being in the middle class. There's not that kind of mobility. You're a laborer, but you would actually have the security of working for this, you know, system. You'd be in your place in the system and be supported as you worked. And throughout the texts, there are these urgings of the Buddha, essentially to keep this social structure intact by maintaining the sense of generous giving among the wealthy and ethics among everybody. And of course, the whole system falls apart as soon as people stop being good, right? Like, as soon as you stop voluntarily giving, if you're wealthy, or you start behaving wrongly in relation to, the whole thing crumbles, right? It's not a rule-based or a law-based system. It's actually a social ethic. And so then the teaching goes back again and again and again to what's needed to maintain the social ethic. And what's needed is that everyone in the larger community actually believes in the power and the goodness of giving and of ethical action. I read a text last night. I was looking for something else. I found what I was looking for, wrote the footnote in the dissertation, and then followed the train of craving for the pleasure of reading texts and just kept going in the discourses. What someone once called, what was it? It was a really great term. It was like, distractor reading, right? Or just, you know, distractor studying. Like I'm studying, I'm reading, it's good stuff, but actually I'm distracting myself from my dissertation. But anyway, I was doing some distractor reading for pleasure in the suttas, and I came upon this text on the nature of giving. It's partly inspiring talking about it tonight. That was talking about a little bit about gratitude, really, and saying, you know, when a gift has been given that is so great that it changes your life, it's very difficult to repay that gift. And this, I think, is important if we're going to think about what a true, like, inspired gift economy looks like. That, you know, putting some money in the basket at the end of class is, we call it a gift economy and do our darn best to separate it from a kind of transactional capitalism. But it's clear in many ways that, like, you come to class, there's the tradition of paying for class, you leave some money at the end. Even if you don't call it paying for class, it's kind of like paying for class, because mostly you don't send me money when you don't come to class. So, right? That would be one way to get further away from the capitalist model, would be to say, here's a way to give to support this group. You know, you can give monthly in a kind of, you know, send in some money, but don't actually give on the basis of actually coming to the group, right? Take it away from the transaction of Sean gave a good talk, so I'm going to leave $20. It was a $20 talk. You know, it's like, Sean was a little out of form tonight. You know, $6.50. Let me see if I have some 10 minutes here. Which, you know, one would have to be enlightened for it not to run through one's mind. So the text actually says, you know, there are some things, the gift of which is so great that they're nearly impossible to repay. One of them is the generosity of your parents in raising you. And it said, and at places in the text, it goes through this whole list of, like, your mother went through all of this painful sensation giving birth to you, and then gave all of this time to you, and then suckled you, and fed you, and cleaned you up, and kind of just gave her entire life to you for a while. Like, could you ever repay that? No. And then, you know, it goes on, you know, to go toward the elements of the Dharma, the various teachings. And it goes through a body of teachings from the very simplest teaching, the teaching on giving, on ethical action, all the way up to teachings that lead to full liberation. And for each one, even the very simple ones, it says that the gift of establishing someone in an aspect of the teachings that are wholesome is a gift that is very difficult to repay. And so as an example, right, the five ethical precepts that we talked about over 5 weeks a month ago, not taking life or protecting life, not taking that which isn't offered, the practice of wise sexuality, wise speech, and abstention from intoxicants that cloud the mind. So many of us based in the Judeo-Christian traditions feel these, I think, even unconsciously as a bit commandment-y, right? Like, oh, I should do good in this way. And we talk a lot about karma and why we should do good in this way. But it's really important to find the shift deep in our view of the world that in the Buddhist system, there's no judge, right? There's no sense that, like, keeping these things, like not breaking them, leads to being judged favorably by some entity and then being established in some blessed state, you know, getting to go to heaven or something like that. But there's the sense that actually keeping them because of karma, et cetera, how the process works, is we don't keep them in order to get to a better state later. We keep them actually because keeping them is safer for ourselves than not keeping them. It's less painful, more productive of wholesome states, better for others. So then, to teach the precepts to someone, to give someone the practice of precepts, the text really says, to establish someone in the practice of the ethical precepts, right? Like, if I preached on them so well that you decided it was a good thing to practice them, and you took it on as an aspect of your own practice to attempt to orient yourself in those ways, for you to establish yourself in that way has done something immeasurable for your life, the texts say, in a way that can't be repaid, can barely be repaid, because it's given you actually the beginning of the path to liberation, which is the most profound gift that anyone can give anyone. And so this text I'm giving goes through many examples, really saying that the gift of the Dharma or Dhamma is this profound gift that that in a certain way, it's almost like even when it's sold, it's still a gift. Like, you know, even if this was a workshop where you're paying hundreds of dollars to be here, the fact that I would choose to teach this sort of strange, rare, renunciate thing that's not that popular and not like something that would be more popular and make more money, I don't know. Something, you know, how to make a lot of money. I'll teach you how to make a lot of money in real estate. Which I could teach, all right? No, I couldn't teach it. But like, one hypothetically could teach it. But to teach the Dhamma, even to sell the Dhamma in a certain way, is a gift because it's being transmitted at all. And if it works, like if it changes your life, then that gift is beyond compare. So then giving becomes the first practice. It weaves into non-possessiveness, so there's the encouragement to give abundantly. For the householder who's wealthy, which in a certain global way means all of us, because you couldn't live here if you weren't, you are not wealthy compared to this place, as far as I know you, but you are wealthy compared to the world, which doesn't help, I understand. But those with resources are encouraged to spend them widely, supporting many, many people. And this is in a very concrete way, right? Not just, oh, I'm going to teach the Dhamma for your liberation, but actually, I have the resources to give food, clothing, shelter, and medicine in a very concrete social way. Part of what this implies is what we could call a kind of Buddhist socialism, where the best use of resources is to support as many people as possible with the requisites of safety and well-being. And this is not a non-competitive, non-discipline-oriented system. Hard to establish in a broad way in cultures because greed, period. Right? Because greed is such, it is the force that drives people. And so tend to go against that stream, and that's a metaphor used by the Buddha, that this practice goes against the stream of ordinary life. One of the things it goes against the stream of is greed. In the ordinary material, like people being out for themselves, gathering more for themselves. So then, the first teaching says, give away as much as possible to support others. And that this giving away not only supports others, which is right and ethical to do, but it trains ourselves in the quality of non-clinging, which becomes the quality that opens us toward the deeper liberative aspects of the path. We learn to not cling to material resources as a training in a way to not cling to the subtler resources of relationships and place and etc. Not clinging or renunciation doesn't mean a kind of ascetic deprivation, right? So there's not a, it's not a teaching that says you should give everything away and become impoverished yourself, unless you choose to go into the monastic system. And this brings us back to the cultural model to say, someone asked me recently what I think is one of the most tragic aspects of our culture. There are so many. But in relation to this topic and many others, I actually feel like one of the really profound things missing in American culture as I know it here, Western culture, is what I call the monastic option. In other words, there's nowhere to go. There's no escape from the market. And in the Buddha's time and throughout much of Buddhist Asia and Buddhist and Hindu South Asia and many other places in the world, but not everywhere, there are monastic systems that still house and employ and care for thousands and thousands, a much bigger percentage of the population. So if you were a young person right now in Thailand or Burma or India, or just starting to be revived in China, Taiwan, Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia broadly, you would have the option to choose to not take the route of marriage, family, business, acquisition of capital, rat race, whatever the path seems like, and to what's called take robes, meaning to enter a path of homelessness, this is the literal translation of the word, bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, and to, in a certain way, cast yourself on the support of the community. And where there's an established Buddhist system, a Buddhist monastic system, you would be able to do that tomorrow. You could just walk in and say, I want to do this, take me. And from that moment, you would never be asked to pay a single cent for the rest of your life for anything, right? You would be given robes, a simple dwelling, food, and medicine as needed, and teaching. So all of those things, the material and then the immaterial, the teachings, all offered completely freely. And I think actually the possibility of doing that is a force in a culture that that I think a lot of us here don't notice it's gone. That even 100 years ago in America, you could choose to be a nun or a monk in the church, and they would take you. I mean, they'll still take you, but there's far fewer ways to do that now, and it's not a commonly supported thing. And so this changes the dynamic of giving, because in a system with a strong monastic component, giving is part of what everyone who has any relationship to the monastic component does all the time, right? If you know monks or nuns, you have to give to them constantly, or else they disappear. Basically, they move to somewhere that they can be supported. They have to. If you value them, you support them. And it's and part of what you're supporting is the possibility of you or someone else becoming one of them, should you choose to. And that's a weave between giving and actually the possibility of release or letting go, stepping out of the mainstream, that we don't have generally here. I can tell you where to go in Burma or Thailand if you want to go and become a Buddhist monk or nun. Or, you know, some places in the West, of course. But that makes giving as a first teaching a strange one for us, because now there's not a common body of social need that is supported by giving in a way that's socially valued, largely. Right? There's all sorts of social resistance, right? There's like some of the remnants to that social welfare programs, right? The idea that we should support those who need it. But often largely disconnected from ethics, religion, or inspiration. Right? The Christian right thinks that the social welfare programs should all be canceled from the federal government, and the churches should do it all. So in a certain way, they're asking for a return to this more traditional system. But of course, we're not actually set up to do that. The churches aren't set up to do that. So in an interesting way, I feel like I'm proposing that we lean into a quality that's a little bit foreign to us as a culture, as a cultural ideology, right? That this is a culture that says, earn your way, take care of your family, circle the wagons, you know, take care of number one. And that to do otherwise is something that, like, maybe the very, very rich do. You become a philanthropist in some way, but you still have your gazillion-dollar home or whatever you do. There's not a broad social ethic that says everyone, all the way down to the poorest person who resides within the commercial sphere, supports thousands of others. So then how do we do it? And just to finish up, I think part of it lives in the very challenging practice of looking at the excessive relationship we have to material resources and spending and the use of material resources as in Western cultures. Go and do one of those "What's My Global Footprint" tests online and find that if, you know, everyone in the world lived the way you do, we would need 9 planet Earths to supply all the resources for everyone to fly around and, you know, eat baby young coconuts and kombuchas and Patagonia shoes and, you know, all this, whatever you do, who knows, right? To go rafting in the Colorado River. To come to beautiful, sweet Dharma groups in expensive capitalist yoga studios. Like, it's very strange. We use a lot of resources, most of us. So I think a first step is to reckon with that, to be really not in denial about our own spending and what we're using our money for. And then to consider a practice of giving, to consider, no matter how thin your resources are, to find some way to give some of it away. Right? Figure out an organization or two to give to that you feel good about giving to. More deeply, I think reflecting on, you know, what what would it be like if our presence in the social field consisted of, you know, responding to need through giving primarily, rather than trying to get things for myself? And I recognize that this is challenged, and this is part of what's so hard about it now in a place like this, is I imagine that the people in this room, we have some fair amount of resource compared to the world, but actually compared to the Bay Area, I would also guess that many of us don't have much extra when you add up rent and all of the, yeah, it's an expensive place to live. I don't want to diminish, right, the challenges of being in a, we're not in a feudal system, right? Almost everyone struggles to pay for their life, right? To pay for housing and healthcare primarily, and debt, all of that. So this doesn't diminish the reality of that. That we're in a system that not only doesn't really believe in giving unless you're a gazillionaire, but also doesn't leave you much extra to give from, and the need is so great, right? There's so little of a social ethic around giving that, you know, whatever you could give is a kind of drop in the bucket. And this is very different from a system where everyone together would share an ethic and support thousands and thousands of people to live, you know, relatively safe, secure lives as monastics and laborers and other folks. So I walk through my neighborhood, Temescal, a wildly gentrifying, absurdly kind of collagey neighborhood down in North Oakland. And, you know, and I'm one of the, you know, hipsters in a fedora and Patagonia shoes pushing a baby stroller along to Pizzaiolo, where I buy a $4 cup of coffee and say hi to my friends. And, you know, I've passed at least 5 people on the street who are in the most dire circumstances imaginable, some of whom look like they could use an exorcism, essentially. The system has so abandoned them. And, you know, the other day I was thinking about the opening of Les Misérables, where the hero, Jean Valjean, steals a candlestick from a bishop's house. He gets invited in for dinner to this church, this priest's house, and to stay the night. He's a fugitive, it turns out, from jail. He got thrown in jail for stealing a loaf of bread to feed his family. This is a sort of social justice tale. He steals one candlestick, I think it is, but he's apprehended by the police the next morning, who drag him back to the bishop's house and accusing him, you stole this candlestick, we're going to throw you back in jail, da 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 da. And the bishop says, oh, my friend, it's so good to see you again. You forgot the other candlestick that I gifted you, and gives him the matching candlestick, saving him, essentially, from a life in a terrible French prison. And it's a beautiful moment. And, you know, I think about that as I'm passing not one fugitive who needs a loaf of bread, but actually, you know, far more than I could empty my house of candlesticks or anything valuable, you know, and not make a dent, even in the tiny walk from my house to my cafe. So there's also that, like, we live in a system where the need is so great and the ideology is so harsh that giving becomes radical, but also in a certain way, you know, Sisyphean. Like, you push the rock up the hill and it rolls right back down again. There's so many rocks to push up the hill. Something like that. That's a very mixed metaphor. So we started a little bit late because I told the story about Zen and I want to have time to talk together. I'll end by just saying I think this is a really challenging teaching for us. The teaching to give abundantly for all of these many reasons. And yet, I think it's still a cornerstone to liberative practice, that if we leave it out, something doesn't get touched in us. Something that needs to be touched doesn't perhaps get touched as easily. So let's just pause for a moment, let yourself rest. Thank you for your kind attention and the gift of your kind attention. And and just opening the field, your reflections and where this goes for you.
I'm curious to hear how the social practice of having such a large monastic contingent, if it connects to the idea of reincarnation, if at all. What, obviously, anybody who wants to can take that option.
Yeah.
But, like, is there a sense of why people choose to take that option as opposed to choosing to be part of the economic system?
For sure.
And is that connected to that at all?
It is, in a way. Yeah. You know, that if part of the ideology or the belief system at the basis of the religion or the body of practices is that beings are subject to an endless round of suffering, birth and death, endless lifetimes of grasping and hunger and fear and the fleetingness of joy, to the point that they get inspired to do something to change that, and that inspiration leads to the practices that take one off the wheel, as it were. And so those are renunciate practices, where we let go of the cravings that even keep us being reborn, you know. And so what is that? Part of what that means is that it's actually very difficult to let go of every last drop of craving and continue to participate in the system. There's a teaching that says that of the four levels of awakening, which are basically just progressive droppings away of things that bind us called fetters, 10 fetters get worn away, that once you attain the third out of the fourth of those, the second highest, desire for material gain and desire for sense pleasures has become so thin or attenuated. There's so much equanimity and peace, contentedness. There's so much contentedness, really, in the heart, that it becomes very difficult to participate in family and business life, because you don't want anything anymore, right? And so then you would only participate out of pure generosity. It's very hard to do, you know, a good business deal thinking only of pure generosity. Right? You have to engage somehow in the system to participate in it. And so then there's a teaching that says that, this is a very, very traditional teaching that says that upon attainment of this third level of awakening, people pretty much immediately ordain, because there's nowhere else to, what else do you do, you know? And that would get challenged in some hundreds of years after the early system, in the arising of what's called the Mahayana, the great vehicle, which was associated toward householders and non-monastics, and the idea that one could awaken fully without going to be a monastic. And that's a whole other sort of turning of the same teaching, in a way. It becomes a bit more mystical and vast. You can recognize the emptiness of everything without needing to do the blatant renunciation of becoming a monastic. But in the earliest system, it's very much the case that the physical situation of monasticism, being a monk or nun, it affords the time and serenity and spaciousness and that you need to do essentially full-time inner work. You know, it's to attain those levels of release, you pretty much have to corral your attention in a kind of 24/7 way, right? The forces of the gravity towards sense pleasures and grasping is too strong to do it in our situation. We can do it somewhat, but, you know, many of us, like, oh, at least we go on retreat for a while. You know, try to find some time to give it 24/7, generally the states that are valued in this system don't arise for most people outside of intensive retreat or monastic practice. So it's a very conducive setting for deeper practice. And in some versions of the tradition, it's necessary for final awakening. There's a few people that awaken, fully awaken, absolutely liberated while they're lay people. In the texts, they always either die immediately or ordain immediately. But it's possible to awaken fully, like quickly, from the state that you're in. But then instantly, you're liberated from everything, and it's very hard to go back to anything at that point. Yeah, Ben.
I'm curious if there's a space or if fear plays into the traditional cosmology and set of beliefs around Dana. And it's my observation of myself, but also the broader milieu here, is that one of the major constraints to giving is anxiety about the precariousness of life.
For sure.
In a system with a fraying social safety net.
Right.
And in societies that aren't necessarily wealthier but have a deeper net, anxiety seems less, giving seems more facilitated.
Right.
So I'm curious how that kind of connects or doesn't connect.
I mean, in an interesting way, the monastic option is a profoundly powerful safety net.
Yeah.
You know, when I first landed at my first Zen center in New Mexico, I'd been hitchhiking around the country as a young kind of bohemian, and I ended up at this center, and essentially they asked for, you know, kind of $300 a month as the fee to stay there for the first 3 months, and then after that you would automatically become staff and you could stay forever. And I remembered when I made that transition into being staff there, and I was like, I didn't even realize that I'd been carrying essentially a fear of becoming destitute. Like, I'm not going to make it in the work world. It's just, I'm just going to fail. And I'm going to be pushing a shopping cart around. I'm going to have nothing. I'm not going to be able to do it. And I didn't even notice that I had that fear until I landed in a place where I was like, oh, as long as I can, like, as long as I'm not either insane or deadly ill, they'll just take me. Like, I could be a total mess, you know, and I could just stumble in the door and be like, I couldn't make it, hold me. And they would be like, here's your robe, wake up at 3:30. Like, that's it, because that's how they are. And that was profound to realize that. Like, a layer of anxiety kind of fell off me that I didn't even know was there, you know. And so I think fear very much inhibits giving in this culture, you know, and a sense that, like, you know, like, pretty much no matter how much you save for your retirement, it's not enough nowadays, right? You know this, right? Like, mm-hmm. Some of you have good retirement accounts, God bless you, you know, may they sustain through
all of us.
Exactly. May they sustain all of us. But may they sustain through the, you know, the crash of civilizations, whatever happens. Through the rising tides. But this is a feature of, you know, of late capitalism. There's just not enough. Except for like five people, you know, who have nearly everything, who hoard nearly everything. And so, very much fear, for sure. And then, of course, you know, the practice is to give anyway, because it still is the cornerstone of letting go, is being able to give, you know. So, I think it's good to, the future isn't here yet, I don't have a big enough retirement account. Actually giving, you know, some amount of money each month to, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center, Greenpeace, Black Lives Matter, and a group of nuns, that's our current little milieu. And for a long time, my practice has been $1 a day to the first person who asks me on the street, and no more than that, but no more people, like, once I've given for the day. I do a one-person-a-day practice. For some reason, it's totally arbitrary. I could give more, but you know, that amount isn't going to touch the retirement. If I was really serious, you know, cutting out the $4 coffees would do more. So that's worth reckoning with. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm afraid of precarity. I'm not that afraid. Or I'm deluded. You know, I'm in denial about some aspect of it. Because I wouldn't be able to live this way if I wasn't. You know. Other thoughts? Yes, Stephanie.
I have a question as to, like, if the texts say anything about receiving gifts. Because to me that's, like, that kind of creates some of the anxiety around giving, too. Like, sometimes, like, receiving the gifts is like, oh, now I owe them something, or I need to do something just as nice. And,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so sometimes you're giving back, but not necessarily with the most generous, open heart.
Sure, for sure.
So I'm just wondering, like, if there's anything in the text about that.
I think that's a great reflection. It's true, I think. You know, again, a kind of transactional ethos has really invaded so much of what we do, you know. It's like, oh, you know, I've been there for this friend when they were, you know, their life was falling apart, like, kind of 27 times. Now I'm having a hard time, and I can't, you know, they're not really there for me. Like, that's real. It's a hard one.
Yeah.
And it's not just the fault of, like, oh, we're in a culture that's transactional. You also want balance, you know, among friends. But there are teachings on, you know, how to receive gifts. And in a certain way, they are mostly what you would expect, you know, which is openly, kindly, without letting those additional stories kind of filter down on them. But there's also structures, you know, there's structures built in. So, like, if you were a nun and you were invited to someone's house for a meal and you and a bunch of your sisters went to this house, you'd be given donations, be given a meal, taken care of for the day, essentially. What you would then do is you would chant a whole bunch of blessings for the people and for the house, and you would bring the devas in and wish them good fortune and wealth and children and all the good things. And then you'd give a little Dharma talk. You give them a teaching. And it's not a transaction, but that's what you have to give. That's your role in a certain way, is to offer those things. At the same time, you're not obligated to offer them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. As a monastic, you know, you are allowed to, like, walk into town, get your meal, say nothing, go back to your cave, meditate all day. Like, that's fine, right? And there's also social systems set in place where you would have a more dynamic relationship, you know, with donors. I think being the recipient of gifts is very difficult for many of us. And again, not to go on and on blaming capitalism for everything, although it's a useful, you know, it works. There's not a strong place for kind of open-heartedly receiving in this culture. You're a moocher, you're getting handouts, you're strapping young bucks, buying T-bone steaks with you know, food stamps. Like there's all of this abuse toward those who don't take care of themselves, whatever that means, right? These roads, these highways, you didn't build that. That whole area of social discourse basically says, if you're receiving something that you didn't work for, shame. Mm-hmm. And I think that infects even our intimate relationships, mm-hmm. you know. And that's something to see through and try to burn out if we can, mm-hmm. you know. And I think the practice of gratitude is the practice that kind of purifies the receiving end. And the practice of giving is its counterpart. Mm-hmm. It's not as often emphasized. And I think it's indicative of something that, like, Bay Area New Age culture loves gratitude but never talks about giving. Mm-hmm. So they're onto a good thing. Like, it's important to be grateful for what we've been given, but there's the possibility that that remains very narcissistic in a certain way. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't actually really involve the other directly. We should stop. It's 23 after a short reflection.
Short reflection, short provocation, short question.
Oh, you and your provocations. Okay, invite a historian.
Go ahead. You're telling us about something outside the market.
Yeah.
About a tradition outside the market. And trying to receive stories about it, I'm trying to figure out why this is hard right now, or why hard for me.
Yeah.
And it's largely, I think, because it's become so difficult to imagine anything outside the market. And that, in particular, politics. The idea that politics is something that exists outside of market forces has become almost impossible to believe in. Or that market structures arise because we do certain things together on very large scales that are political things.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what the parallels are. And I'm wondering what other kinds of things that might be outside markets might become imaginable. Given
right.
a set of practices like the ones that you're describing and advocating for.
Yeah, that's a bigger question than for sure. But
Shocking, right?
But I'll bring in one word, which is a word from my my dissertation advisor, who works in indigenous and feminist literatures, and what used to be, in some ways, called subaltern literatures, meaning bodies of work written by the oppressed or the non-in power groups of people. And the word is alongside. And it refers to systems that do not operate in an antagonistic relationship to the power structure, but in a certain way operate in an internal flow that kind of parallels it, you know. And we could think of like a bartering economy in an indigenous territory within a larger, you know, capitalist system, that or it originally came around talking about, and it grows out of Spivak's, Gayatri Spivak's feminist work and post-colonial work, you know. Can the subaltern speak? Meaning, does the oppressed body of people have a voice in relation to a power structure? And she resists the idea that they don't. And he says, no, what actually happens is they speak a language that the power structure doesn't speak, doesn't understand. And that this, a whole discourse and system actually happens, as it were, under the radar or alongside the power structure that it doesn't even really know is there, because it can't see it. And this is I think something that very much, you know, escapes the market grip to an extent. And of course, then there's all of this, the complexity where when those people actually want to, you know, do something like open a center or whatever, they have to sort of come out of the alongside and engage. And there's this very complex kind of back and forth. But I think there are things that skirt the limits of that thing in a certain way, you know. And in an interesting way, all the religions do that a little bit, you know. I was at a new temple up in the Berkeley Hills recently, and I was loving walking around it. It was fountains and inlaid tile work, a beautiful temple. It was built by the Self-Realization Fellowship people, and it's now run by Tibetan monks up in El Cerrito. And it was beautiful, and I was like, this is beautiful. This is expensive. And I thought, I've said this here before, I thought, oh, religious institutions, sort of in the way that like forests or jungles are carbon sinks, like they take the bad carbon out of the atmosphere and they store it for a long time so it can't hurt other things. I said, oh, like religious institutions can be like wealth sinks. They get rich people to give a lot of money and they put them in useless things like art and pictures of the divine and lovely rooms with nothing in them where people would pray and do other capitalistically useless things. And they sequester that money in a place where it can't hurt anybody, ideally. Granted, all the problems with religions. So I think in a certain way, one of the things that's wonderful about all of the religious economies is that they skirt the pure market logic a little bit. Yeah?
Put a marker on something for
please.
The future.
Please.
The alongside concept conversation is
yeah.
a very funny tension with the like symbiosis between crappy feudal patriarchy and yes. monastic system, as you describe it.
Yes.
Feudalism's bad, too, for different reasons.
Absolutely.
Especially if you're subaltern in various ways.
Which, in those systems, almost everyone is in a certain way.
Yeah.
Right.
99.9%.
Yeah. Right. No, that's... It's always worth saying, and there's the sense that, like, oh, the feudal system that the Buddha describes, it again, it only works if everyone has the same related belief system, if everyone's being ethical. And really, we... Yeah.
If I can say, this is a good reason why you should imagine democracy to be outside the market, because it's a good mechanism for giving the voiceless voices.
And it should be, indeed.
Well,
indeed. That's a good place to pause for the evening. It's a pleasure, you know, to be here. Everything you leave in the basket... has nothing to do with what I just gave you for free. It has everything to do with your practice and your belief in goodness and supporting the possibility of things like this existing alongside the market. So, blessings to you. Thank you for your generosity. See you next week.